howling. It's stopped. Perhaps he's gone. Or perhaps the stranger has slain him.
Aye, and perhaps he's merely waiting. With the Swords and Scrolls podcast, where a rotating rogues gallery joins me in discussing comics and more in the genre of heroic fantasy, I am Jared Savitas, your guide in the realm of swords and shadows. And as always, I am honored to have as guests Jacob and Matt from the Bronze Age Monsters podcast with me to discuss tonight's story. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
So tonight we are going to be talking about a character created by Robert E. Howard called Solomon Kane, who is according to the lead off page in Savage Sword of Conan, number 14 from 1976, September to be exact. But in the lead before the story, it says here, it's got a sweet ass black and white illustration of Solomon Kane with some dead wolves around him. And it says, it's drawn by David Wenzel. Do you guys know that dude?
I don't think so.
I've never heard of him.
He did a lot of Solomon Kane. That's what I know him from. He did an adaptation of The Hobbit, fully illustrated and like, it's almost like watercolor painted ink wash type of look. David Wenzel, cool dude. He draws a good Kane. Says Solomon Kane was a danger-seeking English Puritan in the time of some 400 years ago. That about does it. Do you guys have any familiarity with Solomon Kane?
I do.
Let's hear it. I do not. This was my introduction to the character.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I first encountered him. My first encounter with Robert E. Howard was a collection that I loved called Cthulhu Tales and Other Mythos. It was just Robert E. Howard horror stories. Some of them linked to Lovecraft's world, but I think there was a Solomon Kane story or two in there, and that was my introduction to him. So yeah, I've been a fan of the dour Puritan since I was like 13. I like a gaunt dude with swords and single round pistols riding around kicking monsters' asses.
Now, to tie this into your guys's podcast, when you did your Bronze Age buffet, you covered Bloodstone. Now, he was prehistoric man, right?
He was a caveman, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did he never run into Solomon Kane and those two dudes fight a monster and then, boom, you did your one shot?
All right, let me explain this. So when an IP runs into another IP and they love each other very much, but they don't have enough money to get married, they don't get married.
That's a sad, sad state of affairs. Story.
But Marvel had both characters. Couldn't they have done it? It would have been kick ass.
It feels like the Howard properties are always just falling in and out of Marvel's hands. I don't know, though. Yeah, maybe, I mean, outside of Conan.
Yeah. Well, all right. Yeah. Well, that's the book I want to write.
But my first exposure to him was that miniseries that you sent an issue to us of that we considered covering as well in this one, but we didn't. That one... The covers, the painted covers that or whatever mesmerized me from the spinner rack as a kid. And I was always interested. I think it's called The Mark of Solomon Kane
or the Sword of Solomon. I think it's The Sword of Solomon Kane. The Mark of Solomon Kane is Chaykin drew it and it appeared in like Marvel Premiere or something like that.
Oh, okay.
I think it says that on the title. You know what I mean? That. For two issues, he's in that. I always picked up the comics because I thought he was so cool. I thought he had such a cool look and mood about him. And I ran into him in an issue of Savage Tales that I got at a swap meet as a kid. And I was just like, who's this dude with this like, you know, dark magic staff that he's using to bash zombies and stab as a stake into vampires. And like, it maybe was carried by Moses. Like what, who is this dude? So yeah, I got into him but the movie, how about the movie? You guys seen the movie?
I've seen the movie a couple times. Yeah, I saw it when it first came out. I was excited about it. And I watched a few years later when I had insomnia. I couldn't figure out what to watch while I tried to get back to sleep.
Is it worth it?
It's actually, you know, I think it is. It stars James Purefoy, who was, I think he was Marcus Aurelius in HBO's Rome. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy him. And so It is. It's very 2000s. It's like 2009 or something like that. It's okay, very 2009, like B movie budget, like kind of action monster battle movie. But yeah, it's moody. It's got some slow-mo of like him whipping his cloak around as he does stuff and pulling the things out real slow, kind of like, you know, V for Vendetta kind of vibe. But yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. What'd you think, Jared? I thought it was kind of fun.
Oh yeah, man. I have fun with that movie for sure. And I think he makes a good Kane. He looks a good Kane, and yeah, man, it's worth a watch. A couple other things I wanted to hit on here. So one of our creators are Doug Mensch and Mike Zeck is the artist. From what I could tell, Mike Zeck, this is his first work for Marvel. From looking at his timeline of his work, he'd been at Charlton for years.
Yeah.
But then dude started to kind of leak over to Marvel. And I think this might have been one of his first pieces for Marvel.
Cool.
But Doug Mensch, you guys are very familiar with his writing. Mm-hmm. At this time, most of the monster books are done. But there's like Werewolf by Night is like leaking down, ending. Dracula's still going. Doug is writing Kazar Inhumans. He's starting to write Kull, doing Master of Kung Fu stuff, magazine and comic, Planet of the Apes, Doc Savage. So I feel like he was like, man, I got one more monster story in me. Let's kick it out here.
So I wanted to ask you before we start recording. This isn't based on a Howard story, right? This is entirely Mensch.
Mm-hmm. And it's the first story, the first Solomon Kane comic to not be an adaptation. And Roy had been doing everything up until this point. Well, in the magazines, I should say. Doug takes over for a little bit, and he kind of starts to... It almost seems like... So this story takes place in and around a fictional village or town called Torker Town. Two of the other stories also are about him approaching that town, and those are adaptations. And so I feel it almost seems like they were trying to build like, oh, let's do him on an ongoing adventure and tie, you know, and drop in the stories along the way. I don't know if that was the intention, but that's how it feels like when Doug takes over and kind of continues that line. But I don't know.
I love one of those. I was one of my first Solomon Kane stories. That's like on the moors or a bog. It's like the starry.
Oh yes,
Starry Skull, something like that. I love that story.
Skull in the Stars.
Yes, that was my first comics of Solomon Kane. I really liked it.
That appeared in Monsters Unleashed, August 1973, issue number one.
Ooh,
he was like a character that they were peppering into all the monster books. Tales of the Vampire. He needed to hook up with Bloodstone, man. Come on.
I mean, it makes sense, right? He fits in there more than Morbius does, practically, because he actually fights monsters. Mm-hmm. Morbius is just a freak.
Have you guys talked about Zeck on your show?
We covered an issue on the Shadow Show.
Shadow Show,
I think
that's
this
it was.
Season, Jacob, am I right, of Monster Hunters?
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, we talked about the Charlton Monster Hunter books. And we mentioned him on that. Yeah, like you were saying, Jared, Mike Zeck he started at Charlton. He was there for a while. Like he served his time kind of in the trenches there before he started. Yeah, like you said, kind of meandering his way over to Marvel.
Do you guys have like a tent pole for Mike Zeck when you hear the artist's name?
I think both of us are going to say the same thing, Matt.
Mine's tied between two things. Why don't you say the one that you know we share?
Well, obviously, mine's tied for two things too. So I'm curious if there's a second one too.
Oh boy.
Well, of course, I mean, Matt and I have made our love well known on air about the Fearful Symmetry, which I always like to call it because Matt's like, it's actually called, well, actually, it's Fearful Symmetry, where people like to call it Craven's Last Hunt. And that's, I read that as a kid when it came out and changed my life view. It was the first real like darkness that I had chosen myself and was exposed to. And I was just like, wow, this changed everything for me, my little brain. And my second, I'm tied with the Captain. Are you going to say Captain America run?
That's my third. So go ahead.
Oh, okay. Man. No. Yeah. The run that I remember, his 80s, and it went back and kind of read some of the 70s stuff that Zek did of Captain America. And it's awesome. It's not Kraven's Last Hunt, but it's still really, really good. Oh, now I'm curious, Matt, what is yours? What's your second one?
So Zek is really ultimately responsible for me making the leap from liking superheroes as a little kid to buying, actually being a comic book buyer and reader. It's his art that pulled me to the spinner rack, and it was the first Punisher miniseries.
It's
called Circle of Blood. And that, the covers of issue number 2, that was the first like comic I think I bought for myself with my own quarters that was going to be used to play quartet or something at 7-Eleven. And I flipped it through, and his art completely, it was like, made my just brain fire up like in an MRI machine. You know what I mean? It was just bonkers. I'm chasing that dragon whenever I look at comics. It's that Mike Zek, just my eyes just, you know, dilating, taking it all in the first time I saw it. And then I loved that Punisher, I loved that character because I was 9, you know, and I thought that was the coolest, baddest. You know, Reagan was in the White House. It was just that kind of America then. And then Fearful Symmetry started, and I was a huge Spider-Man fan already. So that was, I was done. I was hooked for life. And I'm still begging for comics out in the street under the bridge. Hey, man.
Those are amazing answers, gentlemen. me, it is that 1986 Punisher series. And just like you, Matt, I laughed while you were telling the story, because that issue number 2, I bought it off the spinner rack, and then I bought it to the end. I've never had an issue number 1.
Me neither. That's so funny.
But yeah, for me it's that, man. Those painted covers for that Punisher run are great.
That's it. Issue, for me, though.
I didn't even think about that Spider-Man story because I read it later in life. You know, once I started learning more about cool superhero stories, I started to check out the stories. And so, but I'm talking the tentpole, like what's your brain snap to when you hear the name?
Yeah, it's honestly, it's Punisher, because it was just before that Spider-Man storyline. So seeing this guy hold this big gun, looking around the corner of an alleyway while some really sketchy looking gang members are coming down towards him, painted cover. It just blew my mind. I didn't know comics could do that. It seemed very grown up and rated R to me.
So talking about early days in the comics and everything like that, I've always kind of wondered with you guys, like, and you may have talked about it on your show, but it's been so long ago, I've forgotten. What exactly was your gateway into comics? Like, what's your gateway drug?
I know that my mom bought some laundry detergent that came with a free issue of Spider-Man, like Inside the Box or something. And it was some reprint of like of Lee Ditko. It was the Beetle. And I read it until the pages fell out of it. And I was probably like 4, 5, maybe tops. But the first one I bought was something during the Hobgoblin saga. That was like, I think around the same time as this Punisher, but it was it's Spider-Man and he's holding on to the Hobgoblin mask and he has a thought balloon saying something like, it can't be Flash Thompson or something. It's this kind of iconic cover. But that was like when I was like, I'm buying these till I die. These are so cool. And I was like, you know, 9 or something. That was my gateway.
Mine's very similar because, yeah, it's just Spider-Man. I don't have memories where I wasn't reading or knew about Spider-Man. I have photographic evidence because there's a picture of me. I'm maybe like 2 or 3. I'm in a cardboard box, as one does when there are 2 or 3. I'm in like some kind of little jammy set in a cardboard box, and I'm pushing this issue of Spider-Man out towards whoever's taking the picture. So I was forcing my comic views on people since 1979.
Awesome.
I've seen that picture. I've seen a picture of that picture.
Yeah. So no, that was it for me. Yeah. It was Spider-Man all the way. I think it's a very common story, honestly. I mean, but yeah, for me, those are the first comics I remember. Like I say, don't have memory without Spider-Man comics.
Wow.
In it.
I didn't come around to Spider-Man until like maybe high school, something like that.
We still welcomed you. We're cool.
Yeah, man. Spider-Man's for everybody, right? They got a version for you somewhere out there, and all the
that's true. Yeah,
bunch of them. There's got to be one you like.
Yep.
I like Spider-Woman. That's Jessica Drew is the one for me.
I love that original run.
Yeah,
read some of that. For season three, it was a blast.
That was really fun. I did love that. There's, I think it was on Hoopla or something. I saw the Marvel Masterworks of the Spider-Woman one. I was just like, put in the favorites because I wanna go back and just read all of those again. They're fun.
Me too. That Waxman one, I think issue 18.
It's awesome.
Still think about that all the time.
I know.
Such a good story.
It's one that I would love to have the physical copy of that one.
Yeah.
That one specifically.
Number 18.
Yeah. I think it's 18. I'm not 100% sure, but
it's not hard to find.
It's a wax man is the yeah. sad, tragic, weird villain of the issue.
Oh.
And there's a lot of body horror.
Man, I love the one and done villains.
So do I.
We need more of them.
Yeah.
This story we're talking about tonight, as I said, probably three times now, originally printed in the Savage Sword of Conan number 14, September 1976. The cover is Earl Norum, and it is says all new Shadow God of Zamboula on it. Corner says that you get some King Cole and some Solomon Kane in there as well. But it's like a King Kong-sized ape with smoldering eyes and this greenish, nightmarish glow miasma around his between his hands as he's reaching out to grab Conan and a distressed young lady in its midst. It's a riot.
How are you supposed to pass this up? You walk by the newsstand, you see this cover. Earl Norum. Cannot get enough.
I have this one on a t-shirt, actually.
Really? That's rad.
Yeah, it's super funny. My wife was like, here, you ape, you love this. I was like, you got it.
Did it have all the copy or just the painting?
It's got the copy and it looks all distressed and stuff like that. It's, you know, like all frayed on the edges. It's fun. Now, also in this issue of Savage Sword, the cover story that they're talking about here, Shadows and Zamboula, does not have a giant ape god. It is an adaptation of a Robert E. Howard story. It is drawn by Neil Adams and inked by the Tribe. Now, is the Tribe... It's the Krusty Bunkers. Is it? They just use different names.
No, the Tribe is the Filipino version of the Krusty Bunkers.
Oh, boy.
That
boy.
Is Tony DeZuniga. That is so. The Tribe would be Fred Carrillo. It'd be, you know, a lot of different people. Alfredo Alcala was not part of that, but it was Tony and then the younger artists. So like not Nestor Redondo or Alfredo Alcala, but Tony and then anyone younger, and they were the Tribe.
They were the That's Tribe. Awesome.
That's so cool. See, this is why you have Jacob on. He knows all the stuff.
Okay, I'm glad because I was just like, oh shit, what do I have to bring? I don't have anything to bring. I just brought something.
You brought it.
There you go.
You did it.
Do you have obscene amounts of werewolf knowledge from hosting Werewolf by Night podcast also, Jacob?
Thank you. Thank you. It gets me ladies all the time.
I bet.
Yeah.
Your wife is so impressed.
She's very impressed.
I don't think Neil Adams illustrated many Conan stories. He did the one issue for the color book, but I had never read the original Marvel version of the Shadows and Zamboula. And it's not like one of my favorite stories until I read the comic book adaptation that was done by Ablaze, which is a European comic book company. And then they did Conan over there and they translated it all into English. The adaptation that they did of Shadows and Zamboula rocketed this story in ranking for me amongst the original Howard Conan stories. This one I was just would read from time to time and be like, okay. But for some reason, that comic adaptation just raised this story for me. So I need to go back and check out Neil Adams' version of it and see. There's also an article about Worms of the Earth, and I did an episode covering that with Jason, who was just on your show recently. What did he talk about for Alice? It was Target, right?
Target. John Target.
John Target. Never forget him.
Just talking about Target.
Yeah. Actually, I already have.
Here we go into the Silver Beast Beyond Torker Town, which is the Solomon Kane short story in here. The story starts off with a prologue, and it is pretty much wordless as we see a man writing with a quill pen at a desk. And we see silhouetted his face against the window as the full moon rises, and he transforms. And then, glory of glories, he jumps through a second story glass window to land and run out into the woods and howl at the moon. Guys, that's big glass.
That would be big glass.
That's a drink.
That is big glass.
If I had a beverage, I would have a sip for
big glass. I don't get much big glass on the show.
No, you don't. Glass is very expensive in your world.
Yeah.
and you don't get it in the Atlas season. So what are you going to do?
No, it's been a real disappointment. So yes, some glass here is welcome. And yeah, like you said, this is fancy. This is expensive glass. Tons of lead in that.
Zach has definitely evolved from the Charlton book that we looked at. He's getting more to his final form, but he's definitely closer to his earlier self than his final form.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I thought too. It's like he's not there yet. But yeah, it is. I mean, his Charlton stuff was pretty primitive compared to, you know, the Cap and Spider-Man and Punisher stuff later. But this is, yeah, like you're saying, man, this is halfway there.
There's an interesting aspect to him at this point in his career where he's almost more of a cartoonist. Here he's getting darker and doing more darker things like that Charlton stuff, like the guy with the big mustache who's like a monster hunter who's like, you know, been to Africa and, you know, all that, like they have the big chin and they almost look like Banana Man or something. Like he looks like he's almost doing a spoof of stuff and cartooning, but here he looks like this werewolf on the bottom right of the first page. Like that's like, okay, this is a sophisticated artist coming out now.
Yeah.
What do you think of the transformation panels?
They're pretty awesome. I mean, I don't know, this whole prologue page I thought was just great. I love, like you say, it's wordless aside from the howl. And just the way the framing and the storytelling is. I just love from him sitting at a desk and then bam, just silhouetted by the moon and then transformation. No, this whole thing, it's a perfect page as far as transformation goes. This is badass.
The last three panels to me are just chef's kiss.
Yeah.
Falling behind him into the woods, silhouetted against the moon. And that close up, damn. Wouldn't change a thing.
It's Jack, dude, running for the woods, right? Forest. So then the next page is some hapless rider going down the road. The transformed man now springing off a rock, tacking this guy off his horse, scaring the shit out of the horse for sure. It's a weird splash page. Like this is where he starts to get weird to me with his panels. And his layouts, instead of doing like a full splash page, you know, you get like a series of like panels growing bigger as this spring attack happens. It's wild. It almost looks like an illustration you'd see in a old Dungeons and Dragons module.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. And I know what you're talking about, Jared, like later on too. And it is almost like, you know, he's graduating to the big boy comics and is trying to do big boy layouts. But they're a little creaky from time to time in this story.
The ink work on that big, the largest panel of the second page, like the horse, like his head and stuff like that, all the detail. He's really enjoying this one. There's a lot more detail than in his Charlton stuff that I've seen.
Yeah.
I think his shadowing is, his blacks are really well placed and used throughout this story, I think, for sure.
Yeah. Which is good for Solomon Kane because it's dark stuff.
Next page, we're seeing the attack as the creature is just ripping this guy apart on the road and bathing in the moonlight, howling. Then we see him leave the corpse, but then slowly a rider approaches the corpse and we know it is Solomon Kane due to his thigh-high boots and hat. And he hops down. He's on his way to Torker Town. He hops down to check the corpse and notes that it looks like the work of a wolf, but the claw marks are, you know, not spaced so widely, and the bite is like real broad for a normal snout of a wolf. But Kane is never one to leave someone without like properly burying him. So he throws this guy on the back of his horse, keeps on riding. The bit that I love about this is the description Doug writes of Solomon, where he says he is a tall, dour-faced man, gaunt, but sinewy, a Puritan by nature and grim by necessity.
I love that.
Really cool.
He's a dour. Yeah, he's goth pilgrim. You know, I love him. I asked you before we started if this was a Howard story or just all pure mensch, because I was wondering about in that first panel where it says like, the guy's screaming as he's being attacked in the first panel, and it chokes short, bubbling amongst the blood filling his throat. Like, that's a grisly little note. Like, mm-hmm. You can hear that, right? Like a scream just kind of becoming gurgly and with blood in the victim's throat. That's dark.
Yeah, all the notes that that Doug is hitting on this are really cool. Even that last panel, it's just like, you know, Solomon Kane resumes his nocturnal journey. His new traveling companion is still warm. So, you know, it's like, so this just happened. But I don't know. But yeah, and Doug's narration, especially in this, is really top notch.
I agree. There's some really interesting stuff we're going to encounter here, like that paints this picture very vividly. In the senses, I thought that was really cool. You know, Jared, Kane's such a weird character because he is such a devout religious person. But I remember from like reading the short stories, like he goes to Africa and like meets a voodoo priest and like gets some device. I can't remember what it is, some talisman or something.
It was
and
the he uses staff. It on the
Is that the staff? Okay, yeah. And he uses it on the rest of his adventures. And it's like, wait, why would God let it? Like, that's a pagan. Like he's a weird character. His mm-hmm. kind of ambivalence, because he's devoutly Christian.
Yeah.
But he can use voodoo stuff to fight evil. I don't know. So I thought that was a weird, cool balance of like, you know, putting up with stuff to do the right thing and the ends justifying the means, I guess.
I agree with you. And the cool thing about that character, Nalanga, is they form a brotherhood together so that they're on even, you know, it's not like he becomes subservient to Kane or anything, because they have a few stories together. They're equals in, you know, the whatever goal they're after, if it's after a vampire or whatever. And that's pretty interesting take on him too, especially coming from 1920s Texan.
Yeah, and Kane clearly respects the guy, even though you would think that he would have disdain for a pagan from Africa. You know what I mean? Like, I was shocked when I read that. I thought, that's cool.
Yeah.
Interesting take. Anyway, didn't mean to derail there, but.
It's part of the conversation. What are you talking about? Into town rolls Kane with the body, and he flings it over his shoulder and enters into an inn where there's people drinking, dude passed out, a gal pleading with the innkeeper, saying, you must stop him. I tell you before it's too late, you must. And in comes Kane, throws the body on the table and gets the whole place's attention. And she says, you see, I told you the truth. My brother has slain a man. And quickly she's like, you know, where'd you find him? Was the body close? Kane's like, yeah, just a mile down the road. And she's like, you know, maybe that's my brother. Keep going. Keep looking for him. And he's out the door, and she's like, he's coming for me. He's coming to get me. You got to slay him before he comes for me.
This is another one thing we're just alluding to. Mensch, like painting this picture, like Kane comes in the door with a dead, still warm corpse over his shoulder. And it says he enters the lacing scents of ale, grease, and garlic. Like, it's just like, I know exactly how this place feels and smells. Like I know I'm there.
Yeah.
I love that little note. Like he said, just throwing him on the table. Like he doesn't drink. I think he's, you know, straight edge too. So he just throws him like
a
couple empty brass cups go flying. He doesn't give a shit.
It's She was funny, ale, grease, and garlic. And too, I was thinking of that and tavern and stuff. And I'm just like, oh, it's like it's the horse brass.
It's Portland. The horse brass it tavern in the Portland, brass. Oregon. Yep. Oh man.
We follow Kane out into the trees, and the people inside the tavern are like, okay, the howling has stopped. Maybe the stranger got him, but nope. As a fist goes crunching through the shuttered window, Kane hears shrieking. He's like, oh, dang, I made the wrong choice. And he runs back to the inn to get in to see this beast werewolf-like creature going at the gal. I love that he just picks up a chair and whips it at the, whips it at the monster and breaks over his shoulder, throws it across the room. He's starting to play with the layers, right? With his panels now. Mm-hmm. Where like Kane in the forest would be a huge panel, like almost like the top third of the page, but then there's panels piled on top of it, kind of trailing the story along.
Yeah, that's cool. You can see in the upper right that the innkeeper, that's there's some Zek, fully formed Zek in that. Like that's, I see a little Kraven in there, like. You can see how he's getting a little less like in that big panel that all these panels are on top of Kane in the forest. That's still kind of his early kind of cartooning of faces, but the innkeeper looks more matured Zek to me. The monster looks great. Climbing over that table towards the girl.
Yes.
He's a cool design. He almost looks like the Kraken or something from that movie, right? Like the weird, like kind of the ear tufts, whatever those things are.
Oh yeah, the big like ear fin things.
Yeah,
that gentleman in the top right corner you were talking about, for me, you put an eye patch on him and that's fucking Dr. Mindbender from G.I. from Cobra, right?
It is.
Holy crap.
Zek, we didn't talk about Zek's G.I. Joe work, but yeah, influenced by him, aren't influenced, but I'm really turned on to him with G.I. Joe.
That's what I expected. So you guys both took me aback, and I was so pleased with your answer because I was like, holy crap, you're right. Frickin' Spider-Man. We get a full page fight scene. Solomon going against this beast, giving his fair share, but the beast claws his shoulder. So now he's got to switch hands. So he's not as good with his left hand as he is with his right. And he's noticing that his sword is pretty ineffectual against this monster. And he figures, well, maybe I'll lead him over close to the fire in our skirmish. This page got a little clunky for me.
Yeah.
It's very overstuffed.
There's too much going on.
Yeah, it's real hard to kind of, well, you know, like Matt and I say, you know, if you have to ask, like, wait, what panel am I supposed to go to next? Then the layout's bad.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's a couple of times in this story where I would read the top narration and then go down to the next panel and then realize, oh, there was more narration in that last panel that I didn't see and read. Mm-hmm. So I have to go back and, like, it happened, like, at least 3 times.
Yeah.
Yeah, they break it up a little too much. Where I did the same thing where I was reading along and I was like, oh, I totally missed that bit. It was tucked underneath in the corner of this other freaking panel. But I love that panel of him hitting the werewolf in the back of the head with the
pommel,
with the basket hilt.
Yeah.
That's pretty badass.
So Kane lures him, moves out of the way. The beast flies into the fireplace. And Kane's like, I did it. Great. Thank the Lord. It's over. And this is the best. The flaming werewolf comes springing out of the fireplace to tackle him to the ground. And Kane loses his weapon and he's screaming. He needs a weapon. A weapon, fools. Or you're going to face this creature yourselves when it's done with me. And the girl picks up a silver chef's knife and she's like, yep, a weapon. Here, stranger. And that goes straight into Kane's hand and into the beast's chest with a rurai.
Right.
I love that top sequence when it says that he taunts the thing to, like, you know, basically like a matador with a bull to get it to charge him. So I'm trying to picture, like, what he's, he almost looks like he's doing a little soft shoe or something.
It
like
does.
And I do. I would love to see this, like, live action, like a werewolf engulfed in flames, jumping out of a fireplace and tackling the hero. That's a great
concept.
I've
seen that in film. I would love to see that.
I would love it.
Yeah.
Boy, the
I
smell
totally
though.
Totally see it. Totally see it. I think that's a good segue for something I wanted to talk to you guys about. So when we had the opening scene where he walks into the inn, I've been watching a lot of Hammer horror this month, and when Peter Cushing walked into an inn in one of the films I was watching, I was like, holy shit, he needed to be Solomon Kane. They needed to do Hammer Solomon Kane movies. They would have been so fucking cool. And they kind of did with Captain Kronos, right? Like, he's got a little bit of that idea. But man, I think Peter Cushing would make an awesome Solomon Kane. But who do you guys think would play a sweet Solomon Kane in a film from any time?
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, man.
Solid.
Holy crap.
He'd be awful to be around those nine months of filming.
Oh, my God.
Because he's method, right?
Stop talking about puritanism with me. My God.
Yes, everything's a sin, Daniel.
Yeah, we get it. 24 hours a day. But, oh, that's good, Matt. Yeah. But yeah, Jared, like you're saying, I mean, I totally can see both of those, but I can really see Peter Cushing. I think I know what I've been watching, you know, a lot of the Hammer Frankenstein movies, and yeah, there's definitely parts of him entering into inns or buildings and stuff where I can see a lot of Solomon Kane in there. I had to go, I was thinking today, and I'm going to go with an actor from the 30s. His name is Frederick March. He was the original Dr. Jekyll. He won the Oscar for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
He did.
I Married a Witch, which I love. Death Takes a Holiday. And this is my vanity showing through, is that Alicia has found pictures of him to where were kind of doppelgangers in a weird way.
Oh, boy.
It all comes back to me, my friends.
That's a good pull.
Every time.
Good pull. I like that. You know, the great thing is that all three of our ideas, thanks to AI, we'll be able to see these in the next couple of years.
Yay.
So
a mashup of all three of those, maybe.
Yes. So. Maybe time travel, different Solomon Kanes from different eras, joining himself to fight against monsters.
I don't know the last time either of you guys like watched even just the transformation scenes from that 1931 Jekyll and Hyde. It's fucking bonkers.
Probably 4 years ago at the Hollywood.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Hollywood Babylon, their pre-code stuff.
Oh, my God. It's so impressive.
It is. Can I tell you guys a fun little game that I discovered a couple Halloweens ago? I decided to watch, I do the Hammer cycles. And a couple years ago, I did the Dracula cycle. And I bought a little thing of brandy. And I poured a little glass, and whenever the characters enter an inn or find a place to stay or whatever, I pour a little brandy and have a little sip with them because they always have brandy. And it totally like locks you into the story. Like, you feel like you're there. Super fun. Highly recommend.
All right.
Also, Baron Frankenstein drinks a lot of brandy as well. So you can apply that same game to the Frankenstein films.
Yeah.
Nice.
We've talked about this, like, I think, on the Discord and stuff like that. But I love that the Frankenstein cycle of Hammer, the villain in the title, the villain is the doctor. It's not the monster. There's a different monster all the time. He is the bad guy, and he's a son of a bitch in those films. Those are so fun. If people haven't seen the Hammer Frankenstein films, I'd highly recommend it.
I do too.
They've been playing those a lot, like, you know, because sometimes, like, we'll just have on in the background or something, like the Roku channel, like Universal Hope Monsters, you know, channel. It's any of those free. I think you get on Pluto or whatever. And that'll just be playing, you know, at some part of our house constantly. And I've been walking in or waking up to a lot of the Frankenstein movies.
Comforting.
Like, I love these. I forget how much I love those. Everyone focuses on the Dracula ones, but the Frankenstein ones are great.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I just did Cycle of the Werewolf yesterday. And the curse of the werewolf. I did yesterday. That one is That's a great werewolf movie, man.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I wish that had been a series. We could have taken some more.
Yeah. It didn't do well for them financially, is from what I understand. So they were like, the money's with the other characters.
I couldn't decide if it was that or if no one wanted to work with.
You can say it. I wasn't going to say it.
Yeah.
Oliver Reed's kind of a difficult.
He's a difficult man. So I don't know. He was young. It's early in his career, but I just think he was born at a level of difficulty and just stayed at that level until he drank himself to death on the set of Gladiator, right?
Probably. I believe
so, yes.
Yeah. Like, yeah, after his 40th beer, this elderly man just died. It was weird.
Yeah.
He's got a great head of hair in that film, though.
Does.
Yep.
Our beast dies, and it as it dies, we were talking about this comic before, right?
We are
a little bit.
As the beast dies, he reverts to his human self, and the girl is crying over him. My brother, oh my poor brother, why? And of course, Cain feels nothing and says, your brother has gone on to his peace now, good woman. It is better that he has done so. Do not grieve over the decision of providence and come. I will escort you to your home. He's all business, that guy.
Yes.
And she's like, well, don't worry about it. Now that the beast is safe, I can get home by myself. And Dr. Mindbender gives her a little shawl and off she goes. Cain asks about the dead man, and he's like, yeah, that's Gideon Parkins. He lived in a mansion on the hill. We saw him and jumped through the window. Nice mansion. We commented on the windows. And he's like, but until tonight, I didn't even know he had a sister. So Solomon's doing his little investigation, and he like pulls out the dagger, and he's like, okay, he's like, this is a genuine silver, this carving knife. And Mindbender's like, there is only the best in my tavern. So Cain's like, okay, well, can I melt this down into bullets for my rifle, and here's some silver coins so I can buy it off of you? This is where the story loses me for a minute here, because like, how long does it take to make silver bullets? From, you got to melt down a knife, make the bullets.
You say a crucible and the tongs, you know, there's probably a horseshoer in town, right?
I would do think that. He has it in his satchels on the horse that he mini crucible. No, see, I liked this little exchange because the way that I was reading it in my head, like there, this exchange is between two just humorless assholes.
Yes.
So he's just like, is it genuine silver? The guy's like, there's only the best in my tavern, you fucking asshole.
Son of a bitch.
Of course it is. Of course it's genuine silver. And then it's just like throws him some coins, like, we'll go buy 10 nice knives, you idiot.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's how I read it too.
That was one of my favorite parts.
In the bottom row of this page, I'm really liking the way Zach is locking in with Kane's visage. He looks awesome.
Yeah, he does.
He's starting to get it now. Like, he's starting to figure out what he wants him to look like, and he's committing to it. It looks good.
I'm real picky about the way Cain looks. Chaykin, of course, just drew him like a Chaykin bro. This is like, I love this look for him. You know, I found when Dark Horse was on MySpace, they would do like comic releases on MySpace, you know, just online comics on their page or whatever. And they collected some of those. Guy Davis did a Solomon Cain. And
what?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll send it to you. I'll make a PDF and send it to you.
Holy
and
shit, please.
It takes place on like a ship, a sailing ship in a storm with nightmarish monsters drawn by Guy Davis. And like his Cain is like a nightmare even to look at. And I'm just like, this is it, man. This is some top line Cain.
Was this collected anything physically?
It's collected in the either second or third volume of the Solomon Cain trades from Dark Horse.
Have you read The Marquee?
Oh, yeah, I have
that book.
God.
I sold my singles of that book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Just applying The Marquee and what he did with monsters and stuff like, and moody, you know, dark period pieces to this, like, just blow my mind.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, okay, I'll hook you up.
Yes, please.
I hook you up, yo. He rides up to the mansion, sees the window broken on the second floor, decides that's how he's going to get in the place, climbs up the side, clambers in, finds the note this guy was writing. This guy's laying it all out before he full moon comes and changes him.
So real quick, did Solomon Kane put this together at the end of the last page and we're just doing that Sherlock Holmes thing where we're just catching up the rest of the story? Did he figure all this out? Because he asked, why would he... Is he just getting silver bullets just as a precautionary? Like, well, there was one werewolf, so where there's one, there might be two. Or did he figure this whole thing out? He just being safe, right?
I think he figured it out because his, like, sword was ineffectual, but then the silver worked. And so he's like, okay. But how he makes the connection...
I'm talking about the reveal.
The twist, like,
Did he figure this out? Or did he just say, forewarned is forearmed, I'm going to make some bullets just in case?
I think also that, but also I think he took note of the barkeep and he's like, I didn't even know he had a sister up there.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, so I'm trying to, like, did he go, oh, shit.
I think he figured it out at that point, yeah.
We get the story all laid out and the narration boxes are all done in this cursive, which is a little tricky to read.
It's very tricky. But, I mean, Matt, technically he's doing research.
Yes, good point.
He's sitting down in the middle of an adventure. He's sitting down to read a parchment.
Okay. Oh, so that's a drink, right?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
It is.
So he's saying that when he was a babe in the crib, his parents were killed. And later on, when he was 12, his grandmother told him what really happened, that they were killed by this beast. And when she came across the slaughter, she had to finish off her, I don't know if it's her daughter and husband, son-in-law, or which way it goes, with a silver stake that she uses looks like a rock to pound into their chests. She had two of them, it looks like. When the grandmother's telling the young boy, it's like a thought bubble is coming off of the grandmother, and that becomes the second half of this panel at the bottom. And then the panels are all like gloopy because he's mind's eyeing this story as he's reading this paper. That's very funny to me that it's like you just got inception right there.
A flashback in a flashback.
Yeah.
Or flashback in a conceived memory.
Yeah.
When he gets older, he starts to kind of follow the trail of the murderer of his parents, and he comes across like gypsy camp, and when he sneaks in there with the silver spike, gets attacked by something, and that's when Kane is interrupted by a woman's voice, and our young lady from the tavern is here, and she's like, what are you doing in my brother's study? And he's like, research. And
just that's all he had to say.
Just some research. I'm attempting to learn why I was forced to slay him, woman, and why he became what he was. She's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, yeah, he had no brothers and sisters because his parents were killed when he was a baby, and you killed them. And she tears off her wig, and she's got a wild mane of pure silver. Oh, boy, here we are. Here's the silver beast beyond Torture Town.
And I would have got away with it, too.
Yeah. Whipped off a wig. That's a good reveal.
Pretty nasty. He was moving into this gypsy camp to like just start pounding stakes into people, silver stakes into people.
But Mensch made a point of mentioning that like he's checked out lots of gypsy camps and this is the one he could intuit something. This was the one where the werewolf was. So he's not just killing gypsies indiscriminately across the countryside. He's giving him a backdoor, like kind of like he's not an all bad guy.
No.
Yeah. And this ripped, torn up cane with his blunderbuss rifle pointed at her. Pretty cool. I love that corner panel of him pulling this gun off his shoulder.
Yes.
That's awesome.
We get another three panel transformation as the beast becomes a wolf as opposed to like a hybrid as her victim. She says, for 8 years, I resisted the urge to rend his flesh with fang and claw, knowing that in slaying him, I would only transform him into a creature stronger than myself. And this, his lust for vengeance would not be dominated by the sway of the full moon or the taint of the silver one. So he had to die, just as you must now die. She like jumps his ass at him Jane. And he just boom rifles her with the silver bullet and she falls dead to the ground and changes from wolf into lady. Kane looks pretty sad about it, but hey, saddles up, puts on his hat, rolls off. Vengeance has been delivered.
Tumble and Tumbleweed starts playing and
you're right, town. Jared. That was pretty quick and Pocket Crucible, guys. That's yeah. all I'm saying. I think it's the only explanation from the tavern to the house on the hill.
Please support his Kickstarter campaign.
Seriously. What if Pocket I told Crucible. You could?
Thanks for having me on Shark Tank. Yeah. This last page. There were some interesting things. So this top row, when she transforms, she is a proper werewolf, whereas Gideon was a wolf man. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's some type of internal, like she's a pureblood werewolf or, you know what I mean? Something like, or cursed or something, whereas he's kind of a tainted, like half-blood, you know what I mean? Like the same type of thing with like vampirism can happen because she seems to be, she can talk while she changes. Yeah. She can talk in that form where he just, I don't think he did talk. I don't remember.
No, he did not. He growled.
So I wonder if it's that kind of thing where she is pure werewolf and he was like a wolf man, kind of like half breed, half blood, whatever thing. I want to comment on that. And then the last two rows here, I really like the art. It almost kind of goes in like woodcut kind of style and gets really classical, like medieval looking.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Really cool. Yeah. I noticed that too. The style really shifts totally at the last two rows, but I love it. Definitely a cool story.
You're onto something there, Matt, you know, because she's also like, I bit him or whatever and made him the creature. And if I were to kill him as the creature, he would come back as a stronger version. So almost like maybe he would have evolved into her form, you know, but then even more powerful. I'm not exactly sure, but.
Like with his intellect or something, you know.
Yeah. I mean? Or
there's some distinction here that Mench is making that I did find a little confusing the first time. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I think Solomon Kane is a blast for stories like this. Such a fun character to explore. And as I've been kind of looking through all the Solomon Kane stuff, I'm just kind of like, man, I could spend a lot of time talking about this character. It's interesting. All of his stories have been adapted. Well, Marvel did a couple of them twice. And then, of course, Dark Horse did some of them too. So, but I think it's the original stories that are really interesting to me, like this one, you know, and I'm pretty sure that Guy Davis one is an original too. And some of the ones for the Sword of Solomon came, the Color series from the 1980s. That's probably right around the same time that Punisher series from Zek was out. I don't have such a big hang up on him as I do, like, say, Conan or Cole, where I'm like, they got to be, you know, those stories got to be a certain way. With Solomon Kane, I'm just kind of like, okay, cool. Just let's do some more Solomon Kane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you guys made a fan of me. I'm ready for more. I'm going to check out this movie. Any recommendations you got? I'm in.
The movie's a good October choice.
Okay. Well, done. Sure.
And I'm pretty sure it's on like Pluto and
it's
all that
Tubi,
stuff.
It's on Tubi. Yeah.
Tubi. Yeah. Can,
yeah.
It's around.
You can watch it. Cool. Can watch it. Guys, seriously, thank you for your time again doing this. This episode could have been someone's first comic book, and we always need a recap page. So if you guys want to tell listeners about your podcast and where to find you, that would be awesome.
Sure. Yeah. We are the Bronze Age Monsters, and we started out as a little podcast called Werewolf by Night, where we talked about every Jack Russell appearance, every issue of Werewolf by Night. Then we switched to talk about more werewolves, Man-Wolf, Jack's later appearances. Then we switched over to Bronze Age Monsters because we just wanted to talk more about the monster comics of the 70s. And so, yeah, we did a Creature Commando season. We did the Bronze Age Buffet. We talked about a bunch of different monster comics. And we are doing our final season now, which has been going really, really well. We've been doing the Shadow Show. We're doing the first issue of every Atlas Seaboard comic that was published in their less than a year lifespan. And so it's good. We're riding off into the sunset in a good way. So yeah, the main show. You can find us on our YouTube channel as Matt edits the episodes really, really well on video with showing you the art. And so I recommend checking out our YouTube channel for sure. But if you just like podcasts, if you just want to listen that way, then yeah, any podcast platform you got, we are on it.
Yeah. If you want to go to the source, you can just Google Bronze Age Monsters Libsyn. And that's a good way to find all of our stuff. A lot of our Werewolf by Night episodes somehow disappeared.
All of them.
Most of them. So, but if you go to Libsyn, they're all there. But for some reason, like Apple Podcasts or whatever, there's missing stuff from the first couple seasons. We don't know why.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, I recommend everybody check out the show. It's been a real pleasure listening to it. And thank you for you guys' output. I really wanted to know how, like, doing a comic book podcast for you guys, how has that changed your outlook on the medium, like, and your relationship with comics, you know, beyond the obvious of doing a show where you talk about them?
I don't know. I feel like I definitely do approach them more critically, and I don't mean that in the common kind of negative sense, but just like more analytically, I guess. Like, I definitely look at what it's honed my comic reading skills. Reading things not only multiple times in preparation to talk with Jacob about them, but then talking with him and getting his input and his perspective. And I walk away with a different view of that work. And doing that for the last 5 years, I feel like I definitely view them in a more, they're still my favorite medium. And I look at them differently than I did before, but it's in a positive way. But I'm definitely more critical and more aware of the nuts and bolts and the kind of things that make the medium work and function. So yeah, I'm more aware of what I'm reading when I'm reading it. Kind of like, I imagine like being a psychologist or a psychiatrist and interacting with people and realizing what's kind of going on behind the face. I think I kind of read them that way, but it hasn't taken away from the pleasure of just the joy of them. I still, if you listen to the show, we obviously still get a ton of joy from reading comics. So yeah, it's just changed the way I engage with them, but it hasn't made it less fun.
For me, I've been all over the map with it. The thing that I'll take away from our entire podcast is that even the stupidest comic that Matt and I get on and we talk about it and we have fun. And I think that's a magical thing. And I think a lot of people, some people have even said like, oh man, I had so much fun listening to you guys talk about that issue. And I went and read it myself and it was terrible. And I was just like, well, yeah, but you know, talking about it made it fun. And so talking about comics with Matt is 100% of the time joyful. As far as comics, I go over that sometimes, you know, doing all the research and preparing all this stuff and working on it really hard. Sometimes for periods, it's made me not read comics at all. And then other times it's made me read too many of them. And I feel like, Matt, I agree with you that sometimes you can't turn that critical eye off. But yeah, my relationship with comics is unhealthy. There's no rhyme or reason to it anymore. It's a weird Joker puzzle box in my mind when it comes to comics. It's different every day, but I love talking about them on our show. So I know that the joy is there.
I will say that I do read fewer comics while we're doing the show, just because it is, I don't know. It's hard to explain. My to read pile has gotten really big since we started doing the show. And I know like once we stop doing the show in a few months, I will start plowing through that. Like, I feel like it's definitely a sense of like, I'm doing this as a job, air quotes. So it feels like I reach for it less, but I'm very excited to get into that pile once we're done.
Probably what helped you guys out too is that, you know, you were reading stuff that you wanted to read that you already had appreciation and love for, and it almost expanded that and blew it up for you guys. It felt like, you know, as you guys went along with the things you were reading on your show, you're not dealing with like, oh, I got to read this week's new comics to talk about them. I'm kind of burned out on this thing. I'm digging what so-and-so is doing with this character. You've already got preset stuff that's classically enjoyable.
There was a period when we rebranded as Bronze Age Monsters when I considered asking Jacob, like, do you want to do this for real? And like, actually try to make money doing this. If so, we're going to have to get a sponsor and we're going to have to read modern comics and have part of the show be what came out this week mm-hmm. and part of the show being what it is currently. And I just didn't want to go there. So I know a lot of people make money review in the, you know, comics field talking about new releases and stuff like that. And I don't think it's a good fit for us. So I didn't even talk with him about it. He's hearing about it right now for the first time.
Yeah. Jared, I've never heard this. This is a scoop. Poison's cool scoop going on right here that Matt was trying to make us mainstream and sell out to the man.
I considered it.
Exclusive.
Not going to lie. I love talking about comics with my friends. And if there were a way to make this my day job, I would gladly work 12-hour days doing it. So it's a niche of a niche market. So we're in a corner of a corner of a corner.
Yep.
And people that found us seem to love what we do. And we love hearing that. We love hearing people telling us, I never would have picked up a 50-year-old comic, but you guys got me to do it and I loved it. I mean, that's makes it all worth it. So that's great. And, you know, just want to also mention that there is a Solomon Kane omnibus that is slated to be released first week of December. People want to pre-order that now.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm going to after this conversation.
It's got everything. Like I looked at it. It has all the Marvel stuff. It has all the Savage Sword and, you know, all the Black and White magazine stuff. It has the Marvel premiere issues. It's got the 80s series.
That's cool.
It's all in there, man. The Dark Horse stuff is hit or miss. There's one series that the artist I don't enjoy that one at all, but some of the other ones are really good.
I want to check out the Chaykin stuff. I don't know if that's something I would be excited. I mean, it's a interesting, I wouldn't have picked him out of a lineup for this assignment.
Yeah. He does an adaptation of Rattle of Bones, which is a really great ghost story and
story.
Like serial murder story. Like it's a surely short story. And, you know, Marvel did it a couple times, but Chaykin did it. And I'm going to talk about Rattle of Bones one of these days for sure. Yeah. Chaykin stuff. Interesting. Striped sleeves, no hat. That's the biggest bummer. I need the hat, dude. I need it.
That's like saying the shadow without the hat. Come on.
And the pirate sash. Not enough dudes give him his pirate sash because he was a pirate and he sailed with Captain Grenville and he kept his green pirate sash. And I love like when they describe him, he's like, he's always in like dark drabs, but then they're like, then he's got this fancy green sash on him, stuffed with pistols around his waist. And it's like, yeah, that's cool as shit.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me to talk some spooky Solomon Kane. I suggest everybody go find these guys' work out there on the web. And thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Happy to be here. Glad you had us on.
Yes, when you hear the fabulous Sun Sword, you know I've got a little bit of outside episode business to take care of. I wanted to say congratulations to Big Jimbo 316, who claimed the loot from the Land of Scrolls at the Baltimore Comic Con. He went and visited Michael Munshaw's booth and completed the quest. A big thank you to Michael for doing that. Go check out his Instagram at artofm2. He'll be at the Ocean City Comic Con in December, so go say hi. Now we are returning to the Battle of the Barbarians next episode, and that will be covering issue number 2 of Wolf the Barbarian from Atlas Seaboard Comics and Conan the Barbarian 49 from Marvel Comics. So if you're reading along, that's what's up next. All right, well, have a happy Halloween, guys. And until next time, when you're on the road to Torkertown, pack a silver stake, a silver knife, a bunch of silver coins.
Come on. Tiny crucible.
Tiny crucible.
You get saddlebags full of them.